after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump isn't divulging any details about his planned meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. He says it will be very soon. I have the date. I have the location. It's all agreed to. Before leaving Washington for a one-day visit to the city of Dallas, Texas, in the southern state of Texas, the president indicated the location and date for the historic meeting had in fact been confirmed. On the White House South Lawn, the president said the U.S. and North Korean governments are in constant contact, and discussions also have included the release of three Americans held by Pyongyang. The U.S. administration is ending temporary protected status for 57,000 Hondurans who have resided in the United States for almost two decades. However, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's announcement Friday said it is delaying the effective date of the termination, 18 months, to January 5th of 2020, to allow an orderly transition. The government of Honduras says it regrets the U.S. decision and it is ill-prepared to absorb so many returnees. The government and Democratic leader Congressman Nancy Pelosi issued a statement in response of the decision, saying that rescinding TPS and deporting tens of thousands of families will only deepen the suffering in Honduras. For Honduras, TPS has been in place since 1999, after 1998's Hurricane Mitch caused devastating damage to the Central American nation. The ending of TPS status for Honduras means that more than 400,000 people from several countries will have to leave and face deportation. This is VOA News. Hawaii's Kilauea volcano has spewed more lava into the eastern side of the Big Island. The volcanic activity followed a magnitude 6.9 earthquake. It is the island's largest tremor in more than 40 years. It has forced residents there to evacuate. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard says that the recent eruption and earthquakes have left many people there traumatized. A drone and other video footage shows orange magma gushing up from cracks in the ground and shaking up through a wooded area. The eruption that began Thursday has already forced nearly 1,500 people to flee from the mountainside homes. Officials also said that at least 100 people were staying in shelters Friday, with most evacuees staying with family members and friends. More than 15,000 refugees are on five Greek islands, and there is a huge backlog of asylum requests to be processed. Authorities say it could take several months to go through the backlog, saying more staff and shelters for refugees are needed there. Burundi has announced a six-month ban on broadcast by Voice of America and the BBC. This is 2 weeks before the country votes on proposed amendments to the Constitution. They include changes in presidential term limits. The ban was announced Friday by Burundi's National Communications Council, which also accused VOA and the BBC of breaching laws regulating the media and engaging in unethical conduct. Statement said that the ban would begin Monday. The council issued a warning to Radio France Internationale, accusing it of being dishonest and having reporting about possible reprisals against those calling for a no vote in a referendum. In a statement Friday, the VOA director, Amanda Bennett, denounced the council's action. A State Department official said the United States is disappointed with the actions of Burundi and has raised those concerns directly with the government. The United States strongly criticized the president there for seeking a third term in 2015. And this week, the State Department denounced alleged acts of violence and intimidation against opponents of the constitutional referendum. Reporters Without Borders also criticized the VOA and BBC suspensions, saying they were intended to tighten the East African country's gag on the media. A toughening of already draconian Kremlin policies on everything from gay rights to political activism are driving a high record number of Russians to seek asylum in Europe and the United States. That's according to multiple Russia experts. In Russia, very few people say that they are completely safe. I'm Tommy McNeil, the VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
For now, you really need experienced people, you need technocrats to be able to restructure and get the country moving forward. And you learn that the president, from the day he took oath of office, has actually hit the ground running.
The Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio is to swear in his first set of cabinet ministers.
ZANU-PF is facing a humiliating defeat right in the face. So I can assure you, something is going to go very bad for ZANU-PF.
Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa calls for unity within the ruling ZANU-PF party ahead of the July elections.
The best way we can honor his name is to follow his path, to follow the peaceful process that he initiated with the President Nyusi.
And the family of former Mozambican rebel leader Afonso Dhlakama to meet this weekend to plan his funeral arrangements. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Hassan Ayariga is an accountant, a successful businessman, and a Ghanaian politician. He is the founder of the Ghanaian Opposition All People's Congress Party, or APC, which he represented as the presidential candidate in the recent Ghanaian presidential election. He was also the presidential candidate for the People's National Convention, or PNC, during the 2012 general election in Ghana before forming his own party. Hassan Ayariga joins me live in the View Studios to talk about the latest development in the Ghanaian political climate. Good afternoon to you, Hassan.
Good afternoon to you, my brother.
How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. How are you too?
I'm well, thank you. Let me ask you, is your party, the APC, functioning at the moment, and what's the current state of affairs of the APC?
Yes, APC is functioning very well at the moment. We're doing grassroots constituency and polling station elections. We're doing 20 membership elections in the polling station to make sure we have executive at the various polling stations across Ghana. That is 29,002 polling stations.
But some people are saying that the party seem not to be visible and relevant, and that it will be resurrected once general election come. You know, it's around the corner for elections to be had. What do you say to such criticisms?
I don't think anybody would say such a thing, because at the moment, it is only the APC that is actually checking the MPP. We have had various press conferences putting the Ghanaian government as the MPP on the right to. We are the vibrant party as of now. We even have made more press conferences than even the NDC.
How are you keeping them on the toes? Because from all indications, the Ghanaian economy is doing well. All indices of the Ghanaian economy shows that the economic policies implemented by President Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo appears to be doing very well. How are you keeping them on their toes?
I think it's the only person or group of people who say such a thing is the MPP. And Nana Addo himself.
The Ghanaian people.
Now, when we want to say the Ghanaian people are doing well, what are we talking about? We're talking about the economic situation in Ghana. How has it changed right from the previous government, that is the NDC, to now? If you were very confident with the 2016 general elections, the MPP made a lot of promises. And I'll take you to a few ones, and we'll see whether something has changed. When we're talking about change, we're talking about a change, a socioeconomic change for the people of Ghana, the one that will benefit individuals, every aspect of the economy, not just people in party. Let's look at water bills. These are things that affect every individual, whether you're a member of a political party or you're a non-member of a political party. These are standards of living items that we actually strategize in order to benefit the ordinary Ghanaian. Water bills, has it changed? Since the previous government left, it has increased. Electricity bills, it has doubled. Housing and accommodation is a big problem. Food and drinks, prices of goods and services have gone high. Transportation, these are basic things that
But wouldn't the government have a little time to really resolve some of these challenges that you raise? Because the government is less than 2 years old.
I mean, 2 years children, I think 2 years kids walk, and sometimes they don't crawl anymore, they walk. 2 years is enough for a government. That it means that you've gone into half your term. And if you're going into half year in your period to serve, the next year you'll be looking at re-strategizing on how to go into the fourth year, which is an election year. So what do you have left if you finish the 2 year and you cannot change the economic situation? Fuel prices are skyrocketing. School fees, people are paying very high school fees. You go to the market, goods and services have gone up. Spare parts, that they promised that they were going to reduce taxes on spare parts, that will make sure the Ghanaian economy buy less, is high. Import duties, when you buy a vehicle from here in the U.S. and you send it down to Ghana, you pay more duty than the price of the vehicle you've paid for here. Are there things that you think that the economy situation is good?
But the government is very aware that it inherited what they called a very troubled economy. It has been stabilized. Many economists have praised the government for stabilizing the economy. The economy, as I told you, indicators look strong and healthy. And some Ghanaian analysts say Ghana is working again. Why do you differ?
Because what I see is different from what they see. In the first place, there are certain things that the MPP government has put in place, which I must recommend, whether I like it or not. Things like paperless economy. If you want to move forward as a nation, you want to cut down corruption, you need to look at the paperless economy. You need to look at the cashless system. The MPP has introduced the cashless system, which is very good, which at the ports can reduce some level of corruption and people handling so much cash, government cash. I think that these are some of the things that free senior high school, it's been, let me say, implemented halfway. But
To some success. Yes, it's been very successful. Yes.
It still has some challenges.
It's been rolled out. Yes. You know, you expect some challenges.
Of course.
Normally.
Of course. But these are challenges that at a point in time, we need to know these challenges before getting in, before you implement it. But when you don't look at these challenges before you implement, there are certain challenges that will come after the implementation, which every government might not see. Those challenges are the unforeseen challenges that we're talking about. But these are challenges that they knew about these challenges before implementing it. So we don't call these challenges a challenge. We think they ignored it. In the bid to win political points, they decided to rush.
Let me ask you about the fight against corruption, because you mentioned it. Special prosecutor has been sworn in, Mr. Martin Amidou. People, Ghanaians that I have spoken with, seem to have a lot of confidence in him, that he is one guy who can go after those who have embezzled public funds or who have stolen public money. What are your expectations of him?
I think that Martin Amidou is a good man. He himself is a wonderful person. But whether he'll be given the time, the resources to be able to execute his job is another problem. And whether he will not be biased, because we're looking at a prosecutor who is supposed to be independent special prosecutor, who has freedom, no interference from government, no interference from the presidency. That is what we're looking at.
But the president promised to give him a free hand to operate.
But his case, he works under the attorney general. So he has a boss. So he's not independent. Are you with me? And beside that, he's coming from another political party, which he had issues with, the NDC. He's a card-bearing member of the NDC. So you don't pick somebody from a different political party who has had issues with the party and left, and you want him to fight those people.
But Ghanaian said he has demonstrated independence. That is why, even when he was a member of the NDC, he spoke against what he perceived or what he saw as alleged corruption, so that influenced the choice to give him the mandate to go ahead and find people who have embezzled public funds to account for them. Isn't this fair?
That really doesn't rule out that he's a member of the NDC, also from a member of the NDC, or still a member of the NDC. Our point is that, yes, he's a great man, but would have wished that the Ghana government or the president picked somebody who is non-partisan, who doesn't have any political affiliation with any political party, so that we see him as an independent special prosecutor and giving the powers as an independent special prosecutor rather than acting under the special prosecutor. As we see, even Martin Hamida has been demoted, if you want to look at the rank of his office, because he's the long-serving special attorney general in our history. So to serve as an attorney general, the long-serving one, and then you go out of office, then you come back, you serve under the office that you were the long-time serving officer. So what it means is that you have been demoted again. But I would have wished the president would have made it independent special prosecutor, where it has its own systems, where it has its own office, without relating to the attorney general or either relating to any office. But as you speak now, he reports to the deputy attorney general, and then the deputy attorney general reports to the attorney general. So what it means is that he's still working under somebody. So that means that the attorney general, its office itself, can prosecute. So why bring in Martin Hamidou?
You recently talked about high unemployment rate among the youth. The government recently released a statement where it has created about 1 million jobs. Now, the National Builders Corps, or NABCO, which is an initiative aimed at addressing some of the concerns you raised about graduate unemployment in Ghana, targeting about 100,000 unemployed graduates. This initiative has been hailed by a lot of undergraduates or graduates who don't have employment. What is your take about that?
I think that half a loaf is better than none, because the graduates, those who are out there without jobs, will be very happy to have a monthly allowance of 700 Ghana cedis and not having at all. But I have my own difficulty in terms of that. Because one, when we're talking about graduate unemployment, we're not talking about graduates only coming out to look for jobs. We have failed in our system of education to integrate into education and industry, where we have to link our courses to industry, where we have to link it to innovative and creative. The students nowadays are not creative. They are not innovative. They read, write exams and pass. And when they come out, they become burdened. What are we doing to change the status quo of education in Ghana so that we can have graduates who are more creative and innovative in their learning process, who are subjected to STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, that when they come out, they become independent of themselves and they do not have to link to government or to any business enterprise to look for jobs. So in a nutshell, all we need to do is to have a system where we actually link education to industry so that you learn to do A, when you come out of school, you have to continue. So all you need is resources to manage your affairs. Now, when I go back
We'll have to continue with this. We have to go now. Hassan Ayariga is an accountant, a successful businessman, and a Ghanaian politician. He spoke with me from here in the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. The first batch of cabinet ministers confirmed by the Sierra Leonean Parliament would soon be sworn in. Lahai Lawrence Lima, spokesman for the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP, says President Julius Maada Bio would administer the oath to the ministers when he returns from a two-day state official visit to Ivory Coast. He says confirmation of the next batch of ministers is scheduled for Monday. But critics say the president appears to be naming old, recycled politicians instead of young and competent youth with fresh ideas to help get the country out of the economic malaise caused by these same old politicians. For reaction, I reached ruling party spokesman Lima in the Sierra Leone capital, Freetown.
Well, whoever thought that, then perhaps the individual may not have been involved, it did not actually attend the committee stage and on to the approval stage, or the individual may be playing politics. But what is clear is the fact that all the appointees are, by His Excellency the President, are qualified and competent for the various positions they have been appointed to by His Excellency the President, and they prove their knowledge and their competence at the committee level. From the Minister of Finance, Mr. Jacob Dutu Safa, who gave in-depth of knowledge or understanding as to how the current economic situation in the country is and how he intends to actually use his knowledge, experience, and work collectively with the team that he has put in place to be able to revamp the economy of this country. And his presentation to the committee members was very much pleasing, as well as the Minister of Defense, the Deputy Minister of Defense.
Some of your opponents in Parliament said that it appears that President Madabio chose old and recycled politicians instead of choosing young and vibrant Sierra Leoneans who will help him with fresh ideas to address some of the myriad of problems the country faces.
Well, if you look at His Excellency the President, Retired Brigadier Julius Madabio, he is a strategic thinker and a strategic leader. In times like this, where you have an economy that is shrinking, and also you have a lot of infrastructure or institutions that are not properly working, yes, much as you need young minds that are very much energetic and have the zest, the zeal to work, you equally need experienced people to kickstart the work so that they lay the foundation and lay the basis, and from which the fresh minds will now kick in to see how best they can help with the president's vision. But for now, you really need experienced people. You need technocrats to be able to restructure and get the country moving forward. And you learn that the president, from the day he took out of office, he has actually hit the ground running.
Since his election, President Julius Madabio has visited quite a number of countries. Some are saying that he's traveling too much and that Sierra Leoneans voted for him to solve the problems, and that all he has been doing is traveling and spending so much money that the country never has, because he said the country is broke. So why is he traveling on funds that are not readily available?
In fact, except that people do not understand, unlike the outgoing president, Dr. Ernest Bai Koroma, His Excellency the President, Retired Brigadier Julius Madabio, has embarked on a very economical traveling. That is, even the number of people he travels with has actually been measured in order to also help the economy of the country. And quite apart from that, we are talking of a country that is really in bad shape in terms of a lot of development sites. And so you need to partner with other nations that are actually developed or that are working towards development, other partners who are ahead of us, so that you partner with them to learn from their experience, learn from their pieces of advice, and also see how best you can tap from their knowledge and their experience to be able to also to engender that knowledge or experience you are tapping from them to be able to help you get the country on its feet. So the expeditious movement His Excellency the President is doing with a very concise or a very measured entourage is also helpful for the economy of this country, and is still part of his agenda of hitting the ground running. So people have to realize that Sierra Leone is not an island, and it's not standing all alone by itself. We need to partner with other member states who are actually ahead of us in terms of their development moves and in terms of their strive also to keep the country on the peak. So you need a president who actually has his own connections overseas, and to engage with those who want to see how best they can help him move his country forward and bring peace and happiness for the vast majority of Sierra Leoneans he is currently leading.
Lahai Lawrence Lima is the spokesman for the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP. He spoke with me from Freetown. Z Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has called for unity within the rank and file of the ruling ZANU-PF party Friday. His call followed disputed internal voting readiness for the country's planned general poll scheduled for July. Launching the ZANU-PF's manifesto in the capital, Harare, the president said the party's leadership plans to review primary election results on Saturday and may order reruns in some constituencies. It came after many of his allies and government ministers were defeated in the internal elections. For reaction, I read George Nkwenanzi, a Zimbabwean political analyst.
I think it is an acknowledgement on his part that ZANU-PF is a divided party, not just divided, but hopelessly so. After 15 November, when Robert Mugabe was ousted from power, there are those who are sympathetic and loyal to Robert Mugabe who are still nursing, you know, some grudge that the military assisted Emmerson Mnangagwa to ascend to power. So these are quite significant in numbers, particularly from the eastern and northern parts of the country where Robert Mugabe's power, you know, was located. So the primary elections that were run in these past few days revealed that ZANU-PF is indeed a divided party. First, the turnout was a record low, the lowest since independence. And that is foreboding for ZANU-PF.
Do you anticipate his call being heeded to by the entire party factions, despite this divisions ahead of the elections? And what possible could happen if they fail to heed his call?
I can assure you that they are not going to heed his call. It's a far cry. It's too late for him to do that. Unless he fixes the fundamental cause of the divisions, which is the imposition of the military junta onto the leadership of Zimbabwe and ZANU-PF. So I don't see him receding on that one. I don't see him reversing that one. So as long as this faction that is supporting the military or that is headed by the military, it has not been sort of neutralized, it will not encourage other people who are aggrieved to come to the party and hit the call for unity that Mnangagwa is making a plea for. So it's not going to happen. ZANU-PF is facing a humiliating defeat right in the face. So I can assure you something is going to go very bad for ZANU-PF.
But what do you say to some other analysts who suggest that even in the face of these fissures being exposed within the rank and file of the ZANU-PF, the opposition parties appear not to be united, and there are similar divisions within even the main opposition party led by the deceased former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, which is now being led by Nelson Chamisa?
That is very true. It would have been a much easier task for the opposition if it was united to vanquish ZANU-PF, given its divisions that are running deep, you know, to their bedrock. However, what we see in the opposition is a fragmentation of oppositional forces. As you are rightly putting across, what used to be the flagship of opposition in Zimbabwe, the MDCT, is in tatters, so to speak. So what it will need is more than just cosmetic approach to unity. What I call cosmetic approach is the invitation of very small parties that have no constituencies, and then you bring them aboard, and then you go around telling people that we have an MDC alliance. When, in fact, the party has become weaker now, with elements drawn from estranged, individuals who have now come back, it's now weaker after the division that came through the sacking of the deputy president, Thokozani Kuphe. You know, she commands a lot of following, more following than all the constituent bodies that the MDCT has taken aboard.
Opposition supporters are suggesting that leaders of the various factions in the opposition should put their egos aside, unite to defeat the divided ZANU-PF. Do you anticipate this happening before this year's general election?
It is possible to happen for such a scenario to shape up. As long as the decision to do so is taken, expeditiously, before it gets too late, before it gets to the nomination court. So they can do that. It's possible, especially as long as they accept that in their current state they are weak and are too incapacitated to defeat ZANU-PF.
George Nkwananzi is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir has ordered the closure of 13 missions abroad as the country faces a cash crunch. Local media reports that the order will lead to job cuts at the foreign ministry. The president's order came after he fired Foreign Minister Ibrahim Gandour, who had called on parliament to intervene to ensure diplomats who have not been paid for at least 7 months are paid. The diplomat, the former foreign minister says, wanted to return home after months of not being paid. For more regarding the closure of the Sudanese foreign missions, I reached Dr. Rabi Abdullahi Obaed, advisor to the communications minister and a prominent member of the ruling NCP in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
This actually reflecting on the economy and reflecting on the life of the people also and the requirements of the people. And I think that this order to reduce the diplomatic missions abroad, this is not the first time to occur in our country. This decision is actually a suitable decision. I think that if we look to the crisis, especially the crisis of the petrol and the crisis in the food commodities and the crisis of all the inputs that is actually be used for production. And I think that this is actually immediately according to the context of the orders and the instructions of our president.
If there were to be diplomatic incidents in the 13 missions that have been closed, how will the government of Sudan handle those issues?
Previously, such incidents taken up by another diplomatic mission that not reviewed. For example, if the diplomatic mission in Jordan or in Syria reviewed, then the diplomatic mission in Lebanon will take care of all the affairs that connected between Syria and Sudan. I think that such arrangements will be made, and I don't think that this will not leave any vacuum, especially now we are stepping upon the good external relation with all Arab countries and European countries, and I think that these instructions and this order of the president took into consideration all these results, and also the shortage will be filled according to some temporary arrangements, as I told you.
Last time, former Foreign Minister Ibrahim Gandour raised the issue, he was sacked by the president. He said, for the last 7 months, these diplomats have not been paid. He called on the parliament to intervene to have these people paid. Isn't he vindicated?
No, actually, maybe, because Professor Gondor, previously he submitted his resignation, but before about 3 months or 4 months back, but the president didn't accept his resignation at that time. Maybe, Professor Gondor, in addition to that, reasons that led him to submit his resignation to the president. Maybe also the disclosure of such information by the National Assembly also will be added to that, led him to submit the resignation to the president. And maybe also the information disclosed by him in front of the National Assembly as information will affect the international relations of the government with other countries. And this is why I think that Professor Ibrahim Odur has been fired by the president.
Dr. Rabi Abdullahi Tiobaer is an advisor to the communications minister and a prominent member of the ruling NCP. He spoke with me from Khartoum. Tanzanian bloggers and rights activists won a temporary court injunction on Friday against a government order to register their online platforms. This after the Tanzanian communications regulator gave bloggers, as well as owners of other online forums, until May 5 to heed tough new internet content rules and license fee of up to $900. Max Melu is the founder and director of Jamii Media, which owns Jamii Forums, a blogging platform. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him by phone in the commercial capital Dar es Salaam and began by asking him about the general press freedom situation in Tanzania.
As we speak, papers are being banned in the country. We have a president who promised to make sure that the media is free, but 2 years after he got into power in 2017, just last year, he said that if the media thought that they had freedom, and not to that extent under his administration. And just 2 weeks ago, we have new regulations which are trying to control the media content in terms of radio print, radio and TV. We also have new regulations for the online content. And under these new regulations, we are supposed to collect data of all people who are online, and we have to share them with the authorities. So we have journalists who are missing in Tanzania. We don't know who is killing who. We don't know who is abducting who. People are being arrested for challenging the president on WhatsApp groups. If you write anything on any WhatsApp group, you are subject to be arrested. And people are being arrested for even criticizing our bulldozer, the president, on social media. Facebook users have been arrested. People posting content on Twitter have been arrested. And as we speak, today I was in court. I was having three court cases, and all of them for not cooperating with authorities, I mean the police, to reveal the identities of our whistleblowers. So in terms of the media freedom at large, we are in dilemma.
And also there's this element of the hitting you hard in the pockets, because I understand now you are required, bloggers, for instance, are required to register, and you have to pay an initial almost $500 and another $440 annually.
Yeah.
That must be tough too.
Well, that's what's happening, because they're trying to make sure that everyone pays for anything they're doing online. But the challenge is, for some people who are operating like Jamii Forum, it's not a big deal probably. $900 may not seem to be a huge cost for people like us who have been in the market for over 10 years. The challenge is, you may try to comply by registering with authorities, but once you get registered, you are supposed to follow these new regulations, which are not, it's not an act, it's just a regulation which was formed by the minister and his team. If you comply with these new regulations, you are supposed to collect data of your users and share with authorities. And the same data that they were looking for in my current court cases are for the whistleblowers who revealed some misconduct within the government. So some bloggers who are complaining, they are complaining about the fee. I understand it's too expensive to pay for blogging, and some people are not blogging for profit, but they are posting like everyone is blogging for profit.
Further to that, many countries across the continent have taken advantage and put in place laws that allegedly are for public order, morality, security. How is that affecting the landscape in Tanzania?
From 2015, there is a trend that is, it's not only in Tanzania, I've seen this in Zimbabwe, I've seen this in other country, African countries. There is something, probably authorities are in touch to make sure that they try to control the civic space, especially at large, because even political parties are suffering the same. I forget the media. These laws, for example, we have the statistics law in Tanzania. Even if you can go to any institution which has been registered and that it is accredited for releasing data, statistical data, if a media house covers that story, even if it was an error which was caused by that institution, you are in trouble. And we have another law, which is the Access to Information Act. it's not into practice. They don't allow it because they had a section which was saying that if you get access to data, whatever information you see as a journalist, you're not supposed to report it to the media. It's just for your eyes only. We managed to cut off that section, and then they signed that act, and it's in the cupboard. It's not being used. And we also have the Whistleblower Protection Act. This Whistleblower Protection Act seems like a good act. Like the name sounds good. But the bad thing is, the only whistleblower who is known by authorities, the whistleblower who goes to the police and not to the media or wherever. And they have lots of these new laws. We have the Media Services Act, we have the Cyber Crimes Act, and we have these online content regulations, we have these election content regulations. Lots of laws going around this the media landscape. So probably politicians are trying to run the show, and probably media practitioners and journalists at large, we need to reunite and see what we can do to secure this space. Otherwise, it's something that is trending in Tanzania, trending in East Africa, and I can see it's trending in most of African countries.
Max Mello is the founder and director of Jamii Media, which owns Jamii Forums, a blogging platform. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Dar es Salaam. I'm still joined in the studio by Hassan Ayariga, an accountant, a successful businessman, and a Ghanaian politician. Well, Hassan, before we went to other parts of the program, we were talking about the Nation Builders Corps, which is NAPCO, a government initiative aimed at addressing graduate unemployment in Ghana. What were some of the concerns that you had about it, and what will you do if given the opportunity by Ghanaians?
I think that NAPCO is some kind of relief for the Ghanaian young men by the MPP government. But if you look at it, for me too, I see it like another opportunity to loot the people of Ghana.
Why?
One, if you look at the NAPCO's 300,000 students who are trained from different universities are supposed to be core builders in invest in food, invest in that, and invest in that, those models that they're talking about. And they're going to be paying each person 700 Ghana cedis a month. If you multiply 700 by the 100,000, you are getting not less than 700 million Ghana cedis in a month. You divide it by 4 point something, and you'll be looking at about $19 million. All right. If you multiply all these by year, that means that the MPP government is going to spend $191 million just for the 100,000 students for their salary for not doing anything.
What will you do differently? Because this is for employing the graduates.
They are not employing them.
What are they doing?
They're not going to employ them. They're going to use them, probably, yes, probably not even use them at all, because nobody is there to monitor really that 100 graduates were actually given jobs. 100,000 graduates were actually given jobs. There's no database that one can click in and have records. Yes, every month, 100 people have been paid.
As I'm speaking to you, there were 40,000 people within the last 4 days who have registered to participate in this program.
Exactly.
Now, so given the opportunity...
Given
the opportunity, what will you do immediately to employ graduates who are unemployment?
Job creation.
How will you create jobs?
When all the institutions of our economy begins to work, definitely we'll create jobs.
At the moment, they are not working, as you said. So what will you do immediately?
That's what I'm saying.
All right.
Look, we invest in agriculture. That's what we're not doing. Everything that we eat in Ghana, we import from outside. And you are telling me there is no job in Ghana, and you still spend over $6 billion to $600 billion to import food for consumption. That means that we don't have what we call food security. And we have vast land in Ghana. Everywhere we have land.
But wouldn't it take time for this to come?
It takes time for you to enroll 100,000 from 2 years ago, it could have taken you time to engage them within the last 2 years. and make sure you create jobs for them that can be sustainable. Rather than employing them, like it's like an, for me, it's like an unemployment benefit given to 100,000 students just to say, go and sweep the roads, go and clean that. I mean, it's not a job. It's just a job for the boys. 100,000 students are going to be on the street of Accra cleaning, washing, and doing all sorts of things. And after 3 years, this is meant to either win votes or just steal the government.
Briefly before we go, what would you do immediately?
That's what I'm
to
saying.
To employ average Ghanaian who has just graduated from college or the university with no prospect of being employed.
That's what I'm saying. You look at where the field of their study. And if some of them are doctors, we're lacking a lot of them in these rural urban areas. There are many hospitals in Ghana that are not operating because of the lack of nurses and doctors. If some of them are engineers, what have we so far done in that sector? We have not been able to manufacture a pen, not to talk of a bicycle in that sector. What are we doing in that sector? We bring in specialists from abroad to train our kids, all right? And they will get employed. That was I was talking about linking education to industry. And we've been producing what I call the avoidable graduates rather than absorbable graduates.
Well, we'll end here and we'll have to come back another time to finish some of these topics that we raised. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Extra. La 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 la. La 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 la. J.R. Yeah. Ram-pa-pa-pam, girl, I'm knocking on your door. Come and take my time and you give me some more. I go beg for you, yes, I can win your war. I wanna see your body, please give me a touch. You're the only one, let me be your man, yeah. Let me have a dance, come hold me on, yeah. Me and you and nobody. I love you, tell everybody. Say now, so the tingo, tingo, tingo. Say now, so the tingo, tingo, tingo. Say now, so the tingo. Then I saw the tingle, tingle, tingle. Baby, I love you. Baby, I love you. Baby, I love you. Baby, I love you. I go go where they say as long as you dey dey. Walk up before me, follow you dey dey. I go do anything, me not care what people say. But you be feel say me come from play play. But from day one I be plan. You're the only one, let me be your man, yeah. Let me have a dance, come hold me on, yeah. Me and you and nobody. I love you, tell everybody. Say now, so the tingle. Say now, so the tingo, tingo, tingo. Say now, so the tingo, tingo, tingo. Say now, so the tingo, tingo, tingo. Baby, I love you. Baby, I love you. Baby, I love you. Baby, I love you. Let me have a dance, come hold me up, yeah. Me and you and nobody. I love you, tell everybody. Say now, so the tingo, tingo, tingo. 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 Baby, I love you.
Why you want for change, you might now. And I even say, if you don't say the new year queen. You love na me had the make him and sing. Let me explain the beautiful is for catalyst. The best na me boy, you never the least pretty face. The eyeball just to kill me. I hope you could give me chance to feel me. Sentimental touching, midnight hugging. Give me the seal for make up all in love. Brown skin, you put it taste like ice cream. Want you for be my wife in a me dream. This love go tight like paper and glue. For play the game like chess and pool and fly. The baby the why it's me alive. You don't wanna choose it, baby, I will die. Come on.
Now you show me the world, now you make her breathe. Now you make her know the difference between love and hate. You get a key to me heart, you the bring smile on my face. Anytime I see you breathe, I face me heart the cold. You show me the things one by one they see, one they see. Truly, now you make a biggie fall.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the venom of the viper cannot do any harm to the back of a tortoise. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On his recent visit to NATO headquarters in Belgium, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stressed the United States is eager to continue to lead the alliance. The United States' commitment to the collective defense under Article 5 of the Washington Treaty remains ironclad, declared Secretary Pompeo. At the same time, he urged greater burden sharing by all members, calling for an increase in defense spending by all member countries to 2% of gross domestic product by 2024. It's now up to each ally to make good on that promise by presenting a credible plan before the summit in July, urged Secretary Pompeo. Russia threatens allies and partners both militarily, as seen through its invasions of Georgia in 2008 and Ukraine in 2014, through an aggressive campaign to undermine Western democratic institutions and the use of military-grade nerve agents in Britain. As such, the United States has made clear that NATO should not return to business as usual with Russia until Moscow fulfills its commitments under the Minsk agreements, withdraws its forces and support in the Donbas, and returns control of the Crimean Peninsula to Ukraine. Fighting terrorism must be a major focus of NATO. The alliance should work with its partners in North Africa and the Middle East to address conditions and activities that enable terrorism, such as trafficking of weapons, irregular migration, and regional instability. Secretary Pompeo congratulated South Korea and North Korea on their historic meeting and the Korean people's aspirations for peace and prosperity. Let there be no doubt, said Secretary Pompeo, we would not be where we are today without President Trump's maximum pressure campaign and the work that has been done all around the world to apply pressure to North Korea. Our objective remains unchanged, declared Secretary Pompeo. We're committed to permanent, verifiable, irreversible dismantling of North Koreans' weapons of mass destruction programs without delay. Until then, the global maximum pressure campaign will continue. As always, the United States will continue to coordinate closely with its allies, the Republic of Korea and Japan, on a unified response. North Korean promises are good, said Secretary Pompeo, but transparent, verifiable action is essential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.